prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Mary N.
All right. Hi, everybody. I'm Gary. I'm an alcoholic. And let me compliment the stormtroopers, as far as I'm concerned, that are showing up here at 2 in the afternoon. This is my nap time normally. You know, but I'm more than happy to share this because, you know, and it's as far as I'm concerned, if you're here last night, this presentation is as different as day is from night. And I was presenting last night, and this is a good daytime topic. And as the case in Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't begin to make up the story. I don't have the originality. Charles Townes, 1862 to 1947, not an alcoholic, never used drugs, lifelong atheist. Of the many different people that ever had anything to do with the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous, he is the oldest and the oddest. Okay? Outside issues abound since Town sought publicity and advocated legislation. So I will tell you that there's a lot of drugs that are here because it is the history of Towns. And so this is not an AA meeting. I don't mean to be breaking any traditions and so forth, but I just need to report that it was Towns had a lot to do with a changing culture in our country. And this is going after a period of time which isn't often covered in meetings such as this one. Accolades for Charles Townes. Of all the cure proclaimers, there was an undisputed king, or perhaps emperor. So magnificent were his accomplishments and so influential his lobbying. And that is by David F. Musto. And actually, it's where I got the King Charles from. The book was published in 2015. I'm not trying to capitalize on the recent emergence of King Charles. Okay? But if you if you're looking for something new to read, the author of The American Disease, it's a clinically well done history of the history of narcotics in this country, and it's called The American Disease because for some reason or another, unknown, we in this country are far more prone to drug addiction than other Caucasian societies. And then accolades. Again, he will be, and he is simply the experienced, enthusiastic leader of what is perhaps the first magnificent crusade against these most insinuating and baffling enemies to the human character, alcohol and drugs. He had happened through one of the chances of nature seems sometimes to arrange to be the right man in the right time. The problem had stirred the genius within him. That was written in 1912, but it gives you the atmosphere of literally how much praise and how public and how popular Charles Townes was back then. The saga of Charles Townes Hospital is the story of the most fascinating institution created by a most fascinating man. He was so personally persuasive and dominating that some observers even questioned whether or not the results of his treatment for addiction might be more attributed to the power of his personality. Slaying the Dragon. If you want the history of alcoholism and addiction in the United States, the William White publication of Slaying the Dragon is the go-to, in my opinion. The book is actually so large. If you saw a picture of my 8.5 by 11 Towns book, it's so large that the index to that book is online because he couldn't make the book affordable. I think even without the index, it's something like 800 pages. It's just magnificent in terms of covering how we have gotten, the history of alcoholism and narcotics. And again, that was published back in 1998. Okay, more accolades. He knows more about habit-forming drugs than any other living man, being celebrated as an expert not alone in the United States, but in China and throughout Europe, where his book is one of the authoritative utterances. He is known in every state capital of this union, as well as under the Big Dome in Washington, where he has worked ceaselessly night and day entirely at his own expense in efforts to pass anti-habit-forming drugs. That was written in 1919, right at the peak of his influence. Now, his real background. Born in 1862 in LaGrange, Georgia. His family, I don't think I have the right pronunciation, Sonoya, Georgia. It's about 50 miles south of Atlanta, towards the Alabama border. In his youth, he broke horses, mules, steers. He had learned extreme determination, very little formal education, maybe in that he was born actually in the first year of the Civil War. Maybe he had an eighth grade education, formal, and everything else that he did after that was self-taught. He moved this, and this is incidentally, if you have the, I'm in process of updating this book because a number of things have been learned since 2015. I did not know about what I'm reporting to you now. When I originally wrote the book, he moved to the Jacksonville area around 1882. He went into railroading, but insurance detracted him. He was associated with the Manhattan Life Company, then Penn Mutual, then the Aetna Insurance Company. He was extremely successful. He married in 1884. He had a daughter, Mary, born in 1892, but that died in 1904. We just learned that. His son Edward was born in 1895. It was the son Edward that was known as the Colonel who took over at the administration of Towns Hospital in 1944 until his closing in 1965. Classic Towns in his personality. He could convince a granite gatepost of his need for more life insurance. Okay, had an aura about him. He moved to New York around 1898 to find his brokerage business, which was announced in February 22 of 1899. And here is a ad that was published in Jacksonville. You can see the Charles B. Towns down in the lower left corner, and this is a Penn Mutual advertisement. He had great success in Jacksonville. And incidentally, for anybody that might be here from Jacksonville, it's a very interesting book called The History of Jacksonville that I came across relatively recently, published in 1895, and Charles Towns has a biography in that book. And you can get that book, incidentally, History of Jacksonville. You can get it on Amazon. Charles Towns goes to the brokerage business. I'm not exactly sure how in the world his talents of being in the insurance business that could transfer to him being a stockbroker. He gave it a good shot as best as he could, but he ran into trouble rather quickly. Here's his legal problems. Failure of his brokerage firm. Incorporated in February 20th, he's convicted on the left end. That's on May 16th of 1899. He's arrested on April 16th of 1901 in another matter altogether. And I think there were at least four different legal difficulties he had as a stockbroker. And by 1901, he was out of that business. Okay, now. The origins of the belladonna treatment, and for anybody that is that's familiar with Bill's story, that's the belladonna treatment, page 7 of the big book. Towns relayed a highly doubtful story, and incidentally, if you deal with Towns, most of his stories will be highly doubtful. Okay, regarded a mysterious person in 1901, later rumored to be Robert Steele, incidentally, that's new, provided him with a solution that became known as the belladonna treatment, claimed it took some years to perfect. More believable story, Towns learned the treatment from a Dr. Marriott McGinnis. Together, they founded the New York State Institute at 118th West and 82nd Street. In 1905, Dr. McGinnis likely learned of this treatment from Dr. Jacob Disinger Albright in a 1900 book. So in other words, the origin of the belladonna treatment, actually this was copied. There was nothing new about it at all. It was just marketed that way. Belladonna contains atropine, hyoscyamine, and scopolamine. Experiments using these substances against addiction and alcoholism had been conducted for many years. Towns had known nothing about medicine or addiction besides his own past smoking habit. He still wanted to experiment with how to find an addict. So the legend about his first patient, a morphine addict, attracted by the ad in the paper. Present were Towns, a doctor, most likely Dr. McGinnis, and this was treated at a New York hotel. The patient became violent. The partner fled. Towns never forgave him, and here he, classic Towns, "I'm going to cure you or hand you a harp." On the fourth or sixth day, the patient went home, quote-unquote, cured. Concluded some definite modifications were necessary in the treatment, and he actually treated Underwood gamblers and prostitutes. His story should be treated with ample skepticism, always. In 1906 and 1907, Towns called an institution the Charles B. Towns School. That's new as well. Now, Towns as an opium ambassador, how this came about, Towns did become a very good friend with Dr. Alexander Lambert as early as 1904. And Dr. Lambert had lots of medical credentials. He was a professor at Cornell University and an active doctor at Bellevue Hospital, was considered an unsurpassed medical authority on addiction and alcoholism back then. He had been personal physician to President Teddy Roosevelt. So Towns, right at the beginning, gets about as connected as you can get connected with the powerful. Congress had, now there's a little background in history here. Congress had voted to exclude importing Chinese laborers in 1904, and existing ones were being mistreated in the United States. So the Chinese had put on an embargo of American products. The most popular of them was tobacco, okay, and most likely Duke. Towns sent to China as a drug treatment ambassador through the suggestions that originated at Oyster Bay, that was the home of Teddy Roosevelt, by Lambert to Secretary of War Howard Taft. And so in 1908, Towns goes to China very proudly on his own tab, so he proclaimed. And he went there with a plan to allegedly educate the Chinese in how to economically treat millions of unfortunates. Claimed to do so out of his own pocket, ran into a bureaucratic stone wall, no permit from the empress that apparently he thought that he needed. He was abandoned by the American ambassador to China. There was too much competition in entrenched. Other people were claiming that they had opium cures, too. Other people didn't want him there at all. So the legend is that he opened a clinic in defiance of the Empress of China. And here we go, a revolver on his lap and another in a holster, daring the Empress to close his clinic. This is literally an episode out of Indiana Jones. Okay, claimed to have cured 4,000 Chinese. Now, also with a little bit of history, there was the Boxer Rebellion had taken place about 8 years previously. That was when Europeans and Americans had instituted their control over a variety of things in China. And at that time, China did not have a modern military and did not want to invite the Marines back, and they figured... So it's believed that they couldn't touch Towns, so he could be as bold as hell and get away with it, because, again, they did not want to provoke anything from Americans. So that's why Towns could be marketed as this hero, brave man in the midst of the Chinese hordes. But he did, upon being over there for 8 months, the U.S. convened an international opium conference in Shanghai in 1909, where his secret formula alleged was shared. Dr. Hamilton Wright of the State Department and Dr. Alexander Lambert, together called the Founding Fathers of American Drug Policies, were strong supporters of Towns on his crusade to deal with the curse of opium addiction. The U.S. looked quite insincere at the American-initiated conference at Shanghai again in 1909 because the United States had no drug policy. You could go and your pharmacist could provide you a cough syrup with opium, morphine, heroin, and cocaine. And there was, incidentally, until the Food and Drug Act in 1906, there was no requirement to put in the ingredients of anything that into any kind of medicine whatsoever. You see, so maybe you could get some really good cough medicine. I don't know what it would do for your cough, but you would sure feel differently after you were done. Okay? The first restrictions on opium importation was passed by Congress in 1909, more or less as a token effort. There was a movement internationally to outlaw these drugs. Towns proclaimed that of the 76 opium cures, and where he ever came up with 76, I have no idea, his was the only one not to contain opium. He returned to the United States as a drug treatment celebrity, stopping in Hawaii to discuss his triumphs with a territorial governor. And this is just an example of one of the newspaper articles that he's established an opium hospital in China. When Towns left China, so did the hospital, for all practical purposes. His triumph return to the New York City, the Towns treatment, and again, which turned out to be the Belladonna treatment, turned out to be a gift to the world, as if Towns was a philanthropist putting humanity above personal gain. Dr. Lambert published the Towns treatment in the New York Times. The obliteration of the craving for narcotics is not a matter of months or weeks, but is accomplished in less than 5 days. Dr. Lambert published the cure in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1909. Again in 1913, that's the top of medical credibility that you could get for the Times. Soon the Towns treatment became the Towns-Lambert treatment in the press, and Dr. Lambert even got that news over to the British Medical Journal. He was appraised in the American magazines Fighting the Deadly Habits in 1912, and then also Collier's Magazine, and The White Hope of Drug Victims in 1913 by a fellow by the name of Peter Clark McFarlane. And here's our two examples. On the left, these are Dr. Lambert in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The founding of Towns Hospital, and Drew helped me out with this originally, to discover that Drew, who's at our controls there, Towns Hospital was incorporated with the address of 119 West 81st Street on December 9, 1909. This was later known as the Annex. His relentless advertising that followed in later years claimed 1901 is when the hospital was founded. Now, some people think, every once in a while, if you run into Bill Wilson, he might take a particular event and might stretch it some. Basically, you ain't seen nothing yet, okay? Because Towns, from the beginning, claims 1901 is when the hospital was founded. Well, remember, in 1901, he was being arrested, okay? So he was trying to cover that, I believe, is a reasonable guess. There was another hospital in Boston that employed the Towns treatment, but actually part of the Towns legend also is that he didn't want to franchise the Belladonna treatment. He wanted to give it away, and that gave it a great status. Again, that was part of his reputation as being a philanthropist. So Towns Hospital actually moved to the prestigious address of 293 Central Park West in mid-1914, and you literally, that's where the millionaires' mansions and museums are today. And again, he had no interest in franchising his hospital. He wanted to set the model, and again, that elevated his reputation to do it. And he turns out to be quite an advertiser. This is just an example when the hospital was first was still located at on 81st Street. And then again, once again, we see and most of these advertisements, incidentally, are not in newspapers. They're in medical magazines. Go. And here's the announcement when in September of 1914, when the hospital is moving to 293 Central Park West. You've got the local phone number down in the lower left-hand corner. Go. And this is a picture. I think I got this one first from Drew as well, of 293 Central Park West. It's the it would be the third building in the picture from the right. Go. More advertisements, and again, he was always marketing to physicians, and the idea there, and of course, a lot of the physicians were addicts themselves, he would set it up so that you could bring your patient, and then you could be part of the treatment structure and have a sense of control over your patient, all right? And this is from Dr. Cabot. Dr. Cabot was out of Boston and had as much prestige in the Boston area than Lambert in New York. But you can't beat Towns. You can't outwit him. You can bully him. The candid, indomitable eye, the astonishing physical vitality. He worked out 2 hours a day. The utter sense of mastery, the admonishing finger waved before a retreating nose. No, you could not defeat Towns. You could kill him, perhaps, but you couldn't defeat him. Boy, what kind of rhetoric is that? Go. More from Cabot about Towns. I was struck at once by the small amount of suffering as compared with much more severe suffering I had witnessed previously of withdrawing morphine. Doctors of the era simply had no better methodology. Anyone who knows Towns knows one of the most persuasive and dominating personalities in the world. That's a quote. Was anxious to find out whether the treatment could be carried out with equal success by anyone else. I do not hesitate to say that Mr. Towns knows more about the alleviation and cure of drug addictions than any doctor I have ever seen. Doctors have had a difficulty of dealing with us. Isn't that true? I mean, I think some of that goes on to this day. Dr. Cabot was as distinguished as Lambert and is credited with having inaugurated social work in hospitals and pioneering psychiatric social work training. Okay, and this is the first of I've actually tried to condense this, but he wrote four Century Magazine articles. This was and believe me, this is but just because I'm reporting this, I don't agree with it. So make sure you. They know the difference there. The odor of a cigarette is probably as offensive to most of those who do not smoke as any other smell under heaven. I consider cigarette smoking the greatest vice devastating humanity today. All right? Now, alcohol is the next month, he writes, alcohol is the greatest of humanity's curses. Now, I don't know what the difference is between the greatest vice devastating humanity today between the greatest of humanity's curses. You can try to figure that out. Okay. It does no good whatsoever. It does incalculable harm. And the alcohol has worked greater havoc in the aggregate of all the plagues. Wow. I cannot say with too much emphasis that the self-respecting pride is the main hope of the alcoholic. Have you ever come across how different that is? From the seven deadly sins, it's about as opposite as you can get. A promise made by an alcoholic, this is very nice for us anyway, a promise made by an alcoholic cannot be properly be considered binding, for such a one is not responsible for what he promises. Oh, golly, isn't it? I want my way in this wicked world. Okay, go. Now, this is very parental. And syringes should not be made available to the general public. Opiates for relieving pain are rarely required. My heavens. And then he goes, few physicians have recognized that it's not safe for most persons to know what will ease pain. My heavens, is that different than what we do today? he claimed anyway, and I don't know where, you see, he doesn't rely on, he doesn't quote people, really. He just makes assertions because, you know, if you buy Towns, he knows, you see. He says he claims only 10% of the pain medication was used for medical reasons. Doctors and druggists were making huge profits. They were the legal dealers of the time, keeping patients indefinitely on some sort of substance. And so they were the chief doctors and pharmacists were the creator of the drug habit in the U.S. And he announced that he would become a vocal public advocate for restrictive drug legislation at the state and national level. And again, the big four, opium, heroin, morphine, and cocaine, were all legal at this time. He advocated worldwide government monopoly of narcotics, international agreements necessary to combat smuggling. That in the 1912 Hague Convention actually was a commitment about a number of countries to do precisely that. This is more of the 1912 Century Magazine articles. Only death or rigid incarceration will keep the addict from drugs, and records show that penitentiary bars have not been able to do so. And if you're in Georgia, you recognize that is a prophetic statement because our prisons are lousy with drugs. And narcotics and cocaine should be eliminated entirely from society for all time if we accepted Towns' policies, so he asserted. Desired that the Towns' treatment be made available to all addicts. That would be, in other words, they would be removed of their craving for drugs prior to being incarcerated. And that would take the problems away of the prisoners wanting drugs when they were also in prison. And alcoholics and addicts ought never become acquainted. The self-respect and pride, which must be the main factors in their restoration, are sometimes fatally weakened. The main Towns Hospital, on the other hand, advertised complete confidentiality, individual rooms, florists, billiards, room service, privacy. Never wanted to have two patients ever talk to each other. Okay, all they would do is talk about how drunk they got. Okay, and the annex was not as exclusive. It was less private without similar features. And now in another magazine by Samuel Murrow, and this is pretty heady stuff, this is the story of China and the opium curse. The Chinese race is engaged in a fight to finish with the drug, and ads are on the drug. He authored more than this. Samuel Merwin authored more than two dozen other works between 1901 and 1935. He praised Towns as a layman, pioneering that an effective method of obliterating craving, and they call that remarkable. Complimented Towns in refusing to capitalize and commercialize his discoveries. That Towns should publish his most valuable secrets and devote his life to giving them away. This is extraordinary. Towns was the experienced, enthusiastic leader of what perhaps the first really intelligent crusade against those most insinuating and baffling enemies of human character, alcohol, and drugs. And now this is the White Hope of drug victims, and no one other, by MacFarlane. Here's an odd story of an odd man with odd ideals and odd adventures whose personality today backs a nationwide campaign in which not one individual in America is without personal interest. And this man on the soapbox with only a revolver in his lap, going back to this legendary Indiana Jones story, there's nothing between him and death for his American impetus save his Georgia-born nerve. That's rather heady stuff. Towns stayed in China 7 or 8 months and treated 4,000 Chinamen, and he stood, again, talking up the 1909 Shanghai Convention, and he left directions behind for treating every case of the more than 150 million that remained in bondage. Anytime you see, at least the pictures I've seen, he's always in lecture mode. He's always pointing at something. He's, you know, and these pictures capture how he's always expressing his opinion because he's right, you see. Go. Okay, now, the Harrison Act, I believe after the income tax, the Harrison Act, which followed it in by 1 year, is as practically as important or significant in terms of our cultural changes as the income tax, literally. The act was passed in 1914 by Congress that led to narcotic prohibition by 1919. The law was originally intended to regulate narcotics, not prohibit them. Towns is largely credited with originating the ideas that led to this often overlooked national legislation. In 1913, he approached a New York State senator by the name of Boylan with a need for narcotic regulation through prescriptions. This had resulted in the Boylan Act being passed in the New York legislature April 21 of 1914. This legislation became the model for the federal Harrison Act. According to the Metro Review reviews in 1916, the Boylan Bill is named after Senator Boylan, but everybody knows it's the work of Charles Towns. The Boylan Act required narcotics and cocaine to be distributed through doctors only by prescription. Their prescription forms would be issued centrally by the state and monitored. No one could stay on narcotics on a single prescription for more than 3 weeks. A longer time required a removal or approval by a medical board. They were attacking the idea that doctors then were keeping people indefinitely on morphine. And incidentally, you know, I've learned that many of the patients that were on morphine, many of them were women who were were introduced to morphine through childbirth, or the afterbirth, things that happened after the birth. And actually, in many regards, nobody thought anything about it. Towns sometimes was bitterly opposed by many physicians for the voluminous paperwork and for government interference in their affairs. So he and Lambert were very unpopular with many doctors. He calls a fraud attack for practicing medicine without a license. He always had doctors at the Towns Hospital, but those doctors were pretty much at this time following his directions. And, you know, here's the rhetoric surrounding Lambert, that he was a comrade, a strong proponent of health insurance, annual licensing of physicians, and creation of standard fees. And at that time, the violation of the Boylan Law was just a misdemeanor. The Harrison Act, which was a congressman from New York, was passed and visualized for being a law for the orderly marketing of opium and cocaine through physicians, and it was considered a tax act. Now, this is something that's always difficult for me to remember. There was a phrase in the Harrison Act contained in this clause regarding doctors, and the clause was, in the course of his professional practice only. This clause later was interpreted by law enforcement officials and judges and the Treasury Department to mean that a doctor could not prescribe opiates to an addict to maintain his addiction. Since addiction was not a disease, the argument was the addict was not a patient. Thus, a law apparently intended to ensure the orderly marketing of narcotics was converted into a law prohibiting the supply of narcotics to addicts, even on a physician's prescription. The act raised penalties, $2,000 fine, up to 5 years in prison. Some 3,000 doctors were jailed. 20,000 paid substantial fines. Physicians stopped treating their addicted patients, and that is believed to include Silkworth. And later on, he very well may be the little doctor that loved drug addicts as well as alcoholics. But he was driven out of that business. It became far too hazardous. Then Towns advocated that laws similar to the Harrison Act should be passed by other countries. He predicted without such legislation, addicts and dealers would quickly adjust to obtain at least as much narcotics as before. He was actually ahead of the curve on that. Narcotic addiction could be eliminated worldwide if all the governments worked together to control narcotics. It seemed to be how much faith that he had in government at that time. Again, May of 1950, the addict had to be in the Treasury Department. Said that the prescriptions had to be in decreasing dosages, and then through selective prosecution, any prescription for narcotics by a doctor became against the law. By 1919, narcotic prohibition was the law of the land. And, you know, and just quite frankly, we were in an atmosphere when alcohol prohibition was going into become the law of the land. And the fear then is that literally if alcohol was going to be illegal, we couldn't possibly allow drugs to be illegal as well. So they had to be illegal so the alcoholics wouldn't go in that direction. Okay, so, but it also, towns claimed a 90% success rate indirectly related to the department, and that indirectly related to the department's reasoning. Why keep an addict indefinitely on narcotics when a fix, which he had, which was the belladonna treatment, was so readily available? So Towns by now was insisting, incidentally, that alcoholism was not an idea, a disease, and he ridiculed the idea. He originally desired a medical model for treating addiction. Inadvertently, he helped lead to a criminal model, which fined or jailed doctors as well as their patients. Prisons became filled rather than empty, which was opposite of his original intent. There was also alcohol prohibition that was on its way. World War I, believe it or not, and these are things that I couldn't possibly make up, but go check that even the Russians outlawed vodka prior to World War I starting, with the idea that if your army was sober, you'd have a better chance of winning. Okay, and Bayer Corporation, actually heroin comes from the German word for strong. It was, and the Bayer Corporation, of course, is German. So that was part of the fear of a result that heroin was going to get all of your children high, and that was going to help the German war effort against the Americans during World War I. So a great deal of fear was involved in that, too. And this is his book, Habits That Handicap. You want to take a look at it? Of course, Paul has an exhibit in the back of Habits That Handicap and two other smaller books that Towns wrote. And it's a lovely display of Towns' literature back there. So take a look at it before you leave if you haven't already. The Habits That Handicap is still in print today. It relies heavily on the Century Magazine articles. The foreword is by Dr. Cabot, the fellow from Boston. The appendix is by Dr. Alexander. He covered himself with a lot of legitimate doctors. He condemned most doctors as being ignorant of alcoholism and addiction and blamed, again, doctors for the creation of the U.S. drug problem. Drug addicts unwillingly remained hooked because they feared the anguish of withdrawal. The Towns treatment was accepted universally. Drug addicts would submit to the cure and to be grateful for doing so. That's a stretch. Proper restrictive legislation, sufficiently wide scope, would very quickly disclose every drug-taking doctor in the nation. With support of the Dr. Lambert and Dr. Hamilton Wright, moderate narcotic use was considered impossible. And that is why any narcotic recreational consumption was evil. The rhetoric of the drug fiend. Towns blamed cocaine for resulting in mixed-sex relations, whatever that means. Nurses could not be trusted to administer narcotics. Too many temptations in the employ of the patient. More on that, he considers himself a heroic pioneer who wanted to only rescue the addicted from their bondage. How then could anyone be critical of him? The truth was on his side, so he insisted. Politics were of no concern to him. According to him, addictive substances poison the body. The Towns treatment purged the body of poisons, much like an anti-venom for a snake bite. So after the treatment, if the person was silly enough to allow himself to be bitten by a snake once more, that did not reflect negatively on the treatment. So, in other words, there was never any follow-up to a patient whether or not he stayed sober. It was entirely necessary because his body had been purged of the poisons. And again, the snake venom is very similar to that. Once the venom is out of your system, you've been healed, and that's the way he approached it. And also, this is in this day of medical insurance, it's a little different, that an essential ingredient of the cure was the patient was supposed to pay for it himself. And if he paid for it himself, it would mean something more to him than otherwise. He also, charging by the week, which was typical of sanitariums of the time, he considered to be filled with perverted motives to keep the patient there indefinitely. At Towns Hospital, you paid up front. So Towns Hospital would make more money the quicker they got you out the door. But they wouldn't ask you for any money more than once. And then even though he claimed at times to be a best friend of alcoholics, the hopeless alcoholic needed to be segregated in inebriate farms, sterilized, and put to work. Still, he considered himself, again, this alcoholic's best friend. I don't know how you did that, but deprivation of alcohol and drugs would never work unless the poisons were purged from the body, therefore the necessity of the town's treatment go. Now, again, his extensive advertising was almost exclusively to doctors. On the left, you see a 1915 example, which is to the doctor, and in the Journal of the Medical Society of New Jersey. And by 1916, there's a number of these, again, that Paul has in the back. He becomes the editor of Drug Addictions and Alcoholism. Dr. Victor Robinson was editor of this prestigious medical review of reviews. There's also copies of that in the back as well. Towns wrote 22 articles in the next 2.5 years. This is, again, for the most sophisticated doctors in the country. Now, not bad for an eighth grade education, was it? Okay, the woman who I apologize to any woman here that's still smoking. This doesn't apply to you. The woman who permits herself to drift into smoking tobacco soon loses all self-control and goes to the limit, and is only a matter of time of how long she will last. Tobacco degrades everything in a woman that is worthwhile. Can you picture a more disgusting human being than an alcoholic and nicotine-poisoned woman? If the young women who use tobacco in the mental estimate in which men hold them, there would be few tobacco users among them. The men who tolerates their smoking are the first to kick them aside for those who are younger and prettier. Now, what does that have to do with a medical magazine? I throw in the mercy of the court. Now, here's one for you. Alcohol is formed in the nature of only as an excretion. It is the garbage vegetation that is discarded elements of decayed plant life. And here we have Russia banned intoxicants just before the start of World War I. And Towns predicted 1 million lives would be saved in Russia and the alcoholic beverage remained banned for the next 10 years. That was going into World War I and the chaos. And very rarely has anybody made a prediction that was that wrong. Towns began to realize there's more to recovery from alcoholism than merely unpoisoning. Even though he made his reputation by treating opium addicts, alcoholics were more than two-thirds of his patients almost from the very beginning. He considered there were unanticipated benefits to society from the World War yet. The mind and body will withstand the tribulations and trials of warfare much better without alcoholic than with it. That a nation to be successful must be a sober nation. And here, two drug addictions and alcoholism, again, Paul has eight different printouts that look very similar to this one. These are two different articles that are there. One of them is having to do, narcotics, I believe. Go ahead. All right. And again, 1916, he's getting full-page articles written about him in the New York Times. And he was having one of those about a year. Once a year, you would see these large articles, and that one is about the dealing with the cocaine habit. And, you know, and so here you have the New York Times, and then here's the Sacramento Star. So he's coast to coast. Okay, go. Now, he's a huge source of controversy. Our own country and the whole world would be better off without narcotics. It would be better for people to suffer untold agonies temporarily to become afflicted with the drug habit. Those who must alleviate pain would be at the end much better off dead. That's easy for him to say. Okay. Towns desired the illegal drug dealers to be treated and the heaviest critical penalties as possible. He believed, yes, in China that the penalty should be death. That was, he had changed his mind about punishment as well. I think he wrote and he didn't remember what he had written previously. I here put myself on record as saying that I think that society is wholly to blame for the alcoholic problem. That was, alcoholics had been wards of the states, mental institutions, and so forth, couldn't respond and take care of themselves. And incidentally, the next time you think about alcoholics being self-supporting through their own contributions, from what he was looking at to what we do today, that is truly miraculous. The Belladonna treatment has eliminated the hazard of alcoholic insanity, and we all know the chronic alcoholic has been the chief source of population of the asylums for the insane, and that, to a degree, might have been true. Go. Now, again, this is not an article. This is an advertisement. Okay, and sometimes it's really hard to tell the difference because he was... You would find advertisements like this in the same magazine into which he was considered to be an authority. So really what he was doing was double-dipping, not only, again, giving credence to whatever his views were, but also advertising. Again, this was in the Medical Review of Reviews and other magazines, Modern Hospital. And he seemed to be, at least through my study, and incidentally, a lot of this, you know, this book was published in 2015, and I was a very fortunate. I was benefited by Google Books, and that's where most of these digital representation of advertisements come from. Google had already gone in and had digitized all of these a variety of medical magazines, which otherwise would have been very difficult to ever locate. Go. In 1917, he was, again, repeating, he was looking as if a worldwide prohibition was on the way. Any progress towards real result on the subject is going to come from the younger class of human beings who do not know what the taste of an alcoholic drink means or personally what drunks mean. His view of the future in this case was a heck of a lot different than what happened. In June of 1917, he warned that the wounded veterans of World War I would be highly prone to become drug addicts. He wrote of the necessity of President Wilson and Congress to take and prepare for a wave of addicts. As the German company Bayer had been responsible for the marketing of heroin in the United States, Towns warned of the danger of the national enslavement by drugs blended with fuzzy notices about spies, saboteurs, and the imminent German invasion to the new world. So again, behind this movement of narcotic prohibition was a huge amount of fear, you know, that the menacing dope fiend was threatening our children. And again, this is actually a another one of his large ads. And again, it's even difficult for me sometimes to tell the difference between an ad and and one of his newspaper articles. Actually, I think I mistook. I think this is actually I'll take it back. I think this is a first of a three-part opinion piece about drugs. Go. In December of 1917, Towns had covered most of what he'd ever known about alcoholism and addiction. So he started including other things. So he broke new ground with coffee inebriety. I think I'm guilty of that sometimes. Chronic caffeineism is much more frequent in women than in men. The pronounced coffee drinker becomes thin, almost to emaciation. That is not my problem. Drinking coffee to excess often marks the commencement of alcohol inebriety and opium addiction. By March of 1918, alcohol produced an injurious effect upon the so-called carriers of heredity, which appears in the great-grandchildren of the original pair of animals. He made that up. He has his own opinions, and he doesn't resource anybody. The only poison that affects the unborn child that is more harmfully extent than alcohol is the immediate effect is that of syphilis. Good grief. Towns promised a very valuable article. His editor promised a very valuable article by Towns for April of 1918. He was to write about the significance of the 1912 Hague International Opium Convention, which meant that he was supposed to research somebody else, which he wasn't capable of doing. The Towns article proved inadequate, and his editorship was lost. Go. This is the Towns treatment. Hourly doses of belladonna, hyoscyamus, and xanthalum on the hour up to 50 hours. Wow. No wonder that would be beyond the reach of a personal physician, because you would need a setup like in the hospital where you would have a 24-hour service and rotating doctors. Belladonna, which is otherwise known as the tropobelladonna, deadly nightshade, contains scopolamine and hyoscyamine, which can cause bizarre hallucinations. But it's not to be compared to an acid or mescaline. It is more to be thought of as a deliriant. Then we have hyoscyamus niger, henbane, stinking nightshade, same family as belladonna, used as an anesthetic. It could also create visual hallucinations or visions of flight. Then xanthalum, xanthalum supposed to do, dried berries of bark or prickly ash, is to help for the potential of nausea. It was considered essential that the patient be stepped down from the substance to which he was addicted. Diminishing doses of the addictive substance would be administered early on. And that theory is that you were stepped down for the substance, there wouldn't be any chance of delirium tremens, and it would be you would be kept delirious more or less as this process was going on, and that was the illusion of it being painless. Every 12 hours, a vigorous catharsis compound cathartics were used, in other words, to encourage bowel movements. That was actually picked up, if you go back and check on the Dr. Spock of the Times, which was named by Dr. Kellogg. He was the child doctor that was most popular. And believe it or not, there are a lot of advertisements that if your child did not have a regular movement at the same time every day, you were to encourage it through the use of an enema, or purging poisons from your body. And I'm not making this up. Truth is stranger than fiction. It was his brother that turned out that they founded Battle Creek, the cereal, which was to assist with that process of helping your child eliminate regularly. So that was purging poisons was part of the medical thought of the times. In terms of this, again, getting the poisons out of the system. The end of the successful treatment resulted in abundant bilious stools. Castor oil was also provided to help clean out the intestinal tract. Some called the treatment puke and purge. Others called it diarrhea, delirium, and damnation. Go. Chloral hydrate might have been used to sedate a thrashing patient or a hypodermic injection that contained strychnine. Bowel elimination was considered essential as an event as part of the purging the body of poisons. The potion would be administered until signs of atropine effect were noted, dilation of the pupil. They didn't want to overdo it. They wanted to keep him basically on the edge of delirium to, again, step him down painlessly. So the idea... And Towns bitterly criticized anybody that varied his treatment. After the 50 hours, the patient was nursed back to physical health through diet, exercise, massage, hydrotherapy, and alcoholic would be gone 5 to 7 days. A druggie might take 5 to 10 days, but then they'd be out the door. The hospital itself was marketed more as an exclusive hotel, suites, privacy, again, individualized meal service, private telephones, private nurse, valet floors, a heated solarium on the top floor for exercising and so forth, very comfortable, and a library and a billiards table. Now, the fall from grace, Towns Hospital changed their advertising, inviting drug fiends to the exclusive address of 293 Central Park West. Bad for business, again, for the reasons that now doctors could not administer narcotics to patients. The medical model for treating alcoholism addiction was discredited due to the high rate of relapse. Even Dr. Lambert, Towns' original greatest supporter, was disillusioned. Towns' credibility fell, so did his claims for the efficacy of the Towns' treatment. It became more extravagant as a cure for tobacco, coffee, tea, bromides, marijuana, cocaine, formaldehyde, in addition to opiates and alcohol. From Dr. David Musto, again, a book, The American Disease, which I highly recommend for somebody that really wants to go through this period, the Towns story reveals the deep belief among many leading Americans that a cure existed for addiction and that Towns had it. Dr. Musto gave his following reasoning for the treatment's apparent success. The physiological basis for the treatment was quite reasonable. Opiate withdrawal usually produces sweating, diarrhea, and vomiting. The atropine line action of the formula appeared pharmacologically to counteract these symptoms, thereby aiding the patient in lasting out the withdrawal. And here's how his advertising started to change. You can see that on the left you have a treatment for insomnia, and on the right people that are dealing with the fact that alcohol was in prohibition go. And then here again, more advertising. You've got tobacco on the left. And then this, basically, on the right, you have nervous conditions that the Towns thought he could also attract patients. Go. Now, while he claimed to never have any effect, every once in a while you can find that he did have a failure. This was a result of a suicide, somebody jumping out of a window, because actually he believed that physical restraints was a form of barbarism, and if you followed his advice, it would be not necessary for physical restraints to be used, but that person ended up jumping out of a window. Go. And I have not seen, again, back there, I have a couple of examples of the pamphlets that he was providing. Every couple of years, he would provide a 16-page pamphlet. The one on the right has five doctors down. It's too small to read, but the five doctors that always gave him great credibility. There's probably 8 or 10 of the pamphlets that are back on there. You can take a look at the work that Paul's done. There's also at this time period. Drug and alcoholic sickness, and one is 77 pages, the other was 44 pages. They're practically booklets, but they are all used for purposes of advertising. And from what he printed, he never changed a word of his advertising, never having a failure and so forth, even though that the reality was quite different. And this is it was Drew that showed me one of these first. These are some of the pictures that were in those pamphlets of Towns Hospital and the various equipment. The lower middle one is probably some of the hydroponic equipment, and the one on the right is the solarium that was up on the sixth floor. And here we finally arrive at something that has to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, and this is Dr. William Silkworth. The start date of Silkworth at Towns Hospital has been listed as 1929, 1930, and 1932. He may have originally been the little doctor that loved addicts, but he was probably chased out of that business by 1920. Hardworking but independent enterprises were his. When he tried to put out his own shingle, he was not successful. He was reportedly hired for $40 a week by Towns, which somehow doesn't seem to fit with the title of medical director, which he became no later than 1932. I rely heavily on a book called Dale Mitchell, which just has the title of Silkworth, which is a book that's out of print. It's hard to find, but it has information on Silkworth that I've never seen anywhere else. Former patients were speaking publicly about the failure and relapse at Towns. There's no record known of Silkworth's opinions of Towns, because after all, that was his employer. Silkworth had a professional relationship with Dr. Alexander long before Lambert was associated with Towns. Silkworth was tutored by Lambert at Bellevue Hospital before 1900. Silkworth may have first got his allergy concept from Lambert's reading of the Quarterly Journal of Inebriety that introduced Dr. Benjamin Russ's theory that intemperance was a disease in an address given by Dr. Theodore L. Mason in the journal's first issue in December of 1876. Silkworth had written Notes of the Jungle Plant in 1908, which describe a Malaysian plant that he was led to believe that there was may be present in the remedy an active ingredient, anti-opium, in its properties. But Silkworth, unlike Towns, never got as far as treating a patient with the substance. But again, at the time, from very reputable people that were looking for a medical model to a cure, they figured that some sort of substance might make it possible for an addict or an alcoholic to stop his habit. Silkworth was very disappointed with the initial results at Towns. The fatality rates were high from alcohol withdrawal across the nation. Success rate, according to Silkworth, in the 2% range. Towns is still saying, we never had a negative result. Silkworth had his own ideas of how to help alcoholics. Now, you know, and by 1932, one has to keep in mind is that Towns is 70 years old and beginning to withdraw from the daily control. So Silkworth is getting to actually do pretty much what he thinks is the appropriate thing to do. He reinvented the treatment model at Towns, but there is initial evidence that belladonna was employed to some degree. I'd love to, if we ever found the records of Towns Hospital, which may or may not be still survive, it would be very interesting to find out what the truth was. Wilson is quoted in the first visit in 1933. At Towns in those days, they gave one some sedative, an occasional shot of whiskey. There we go with stepping down, which was taken down to nothing in about 3 days. Meanwhile, they plied you with castor oil and belladonna. Okay? But if he was going through a 50-hour puke and purge, you would think he would give it a lot more emphasis than he did. That's why whatever treatment it was, I don't think it was as Towns originally. And now, Wilson on Towns, one forenoon, I bumped into Charlie Towns. Now, I swear, that is a hidden resentment. Charlie, okay? You'll find him, you know, even on the 12 and 12, when you go into tradition 2, he's Charlie, okay? And in everywhere else in history, the only place he's called Charlie is in AA. Everywhere else, it's Charles, much more formal. The proprietor, Charlie, was one of those American success stories. He had been a poor Georgia farm boy and later banging around the world. His travels had taken him to China, where he'd seen belladonna applied to opium addicts. That's an error, obviously. He's the one that brought belladonna to China. Okay? That's, again, from Bill W., my first 40 years. You know, and you just got to ask, did Towns' opinions on tobacco influence his opinions of Wilson? Did Bill ever smoke as a patient or volunteer in the hospital? Again, after what Towns had written about tobacco, he had written that unless you quit smoking, you couldn't get sober. That's how, and of course, Wilson never stopped smoking. So I think that's my theory anyway for a little bit of a hidden resentment because, of course, Bill didn't quit smoking until just before his death. Wilson on Silkworth and Towns. No two people could have been set in greater contrast than Towns and Dr. Silkworth. Towns lectured Wilson, but Wilson did admit that Towns had a finer nature. After the first meeting, the spectacle of Towns' success and his vast will to live lustily got me down. Wilson had long talks with Silkworth, but not Towns. Silkworth provided understanding and encouragement to Bill. Some insist upon describing Towns as a quack, but Wilson doesn't use that terminology. Silkworth's two significant contributions, according to Wilson. One, Silkworth's capacity to somehow engage the utter confidence of the alcoholic. Two, his contribution of alcoholism being an illness. And that's, again, from Bill Wilson's for the first 40 years. All the credit goes to Silkworth, not Towns. And, there's sometimes a confusion because the doctor's opinion suggests there were three visits to Towns Hospital by Bill. There were four. Go. His last relapse was begun on Armistice Day in 1934. He arrived at Towns Hospital for the fourth time. Robert Thompson vividly described how Wilson showed up one afternoon, only a few weeks. Bowels had turned to water and had gushed down his pants. Oh. And now, despite the sedation, all of his thoughts and memories, even his strained, disjointed dreams, were stained by his own terrible stench, his own unspeakable shame. The belladonna described by Wilson during his fourth visit as part of the usual treatment suggests that belladonna was used in some limited capacity. There's some evidence that Dr. Bob used the Towns treatment in Akron, page 78 of Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, Eddie. They had to go grab Eddie, and he and Bob toured over to Cleveland in the middle of the night, got him, and gave him the Towns Hospital treatment. Also, the letter to Frank Amos, the Towns treatment was in use in Akron with Towns' consent at no profit to himself. Go. Now, there, if you're around for a while, you will get some people who will say that his white light experience was a direct result of belladonna, and that is nonsense. And here's the reasoning behind that. Towns would sell anything. He was a consummate salesman. And don't you think if they could administer belladonna and get someone to have a hot flash, resulted in positive results, don't you think he would have advertised the hilt out of that? Bill is the only known hot flash or white light experience that was ever recorded at Towns. So the likeliness that it was from belladonna is, in my opinion, is absurd. But at the same time, Silkworth told Bill Wilson to take advantage of the event. Atheist Towns probably would have told Wilson he was crazy. Okay, so here we go again with thanks to Silkworth. Go. Now, this is also somewhat of a disputed. The fact he had his job offer from Charles Towns, and this is showing Towns seeing what's going on right in front of him. The published dates for the job offer vary from 1936 to 1939. The Diary of Lois says December of 1936. If you look at Tradition 2, they will say 3 years after when the program was 3 years old. That would have put it in 1938. When the job offer, I think actually there might have been multiple job offers, and that's why there's such a dispute over when the actual date when it actually took place. There's John Barton, who a number of years ago on AA History Lovers, he provided a list of the first 100 sober. And as a result of how many people got sober in 1936 in New York? Answer is one. How many people got sober in 1937 in New York? I believe the answer then is six or seven. But then by 1938, there were 28 that got sober in New York in that year. So when you see the remark, someday Madison Square Garden will be filled with alcoholics. That's a rough, very rough paraphrase. It's just most likely that quote would have come much later when that many people were getting sober in New York, not in 1936 when there was only one person that got sober that year. And Mike was talking about, and it really is miraculous, how could a three-time loser be trusted to stay sober and talk to patients? Did Silkworth have to be present for Wilson to see? I don't believe so. Bill wrote in 1957, when I wanted to work with alcoholics, Silkworth led me right there in his hospital, risking his professional reputation. Now, there's a pamphlet, Three Talks by Medical Societies. And in that pamphlet, you look at page 26, I believe it is. And if you have one, take a look at that. They talk about the 75 failures in that pamphlet. And this was that medical magazine was published in 1944. Now, I'm bringing this up because it's actually a five-month period from December of 1934 until Mother's Day of May 12th. Okay, and during that five-month period, we commonly accept that Bill went around preaching and nobody got sober. But in the pamphlet, when they're talking about 75 failures, there's 64 successes of people that they wrote off and thought they didn't have a chance of getting sober. Well, 64 of them did get sober, and we have a challenge. Who were that 64, and where were they? What were their names? Were they in New York? It could have been that Bill planted the seed at Towns Hospital. We've just never found out who the people actually were. Okay, it was Dr. Alexander that convinced Silkworth to give Bill Wilson the chance to visit patients. That was remarkable. And Dale Mitchell, the little doctor that loved drunks, asserted, Silkworth had exposure to Courtney Baylor and Richard Peabody. Laymen could be as effective as doctors with patients. That was part of the background that Lambert had that made the recommendation. Towns had written in the past that basically he wanted no personal contact with any patient, much less allowing an ex-patient to talk, sometimes to preach to other patients. So this is truly, whatever happened to Wilson, people were recognizing it, and allowing this major change to take place at Towns Hospital. And going on with the, this is Towns to Wilson. Silkworth really scared me by his cooperation with you, but all that has changed. This is my own opinion. This is first recorded positive change by Charles Towns at the tender age of 72. And then I've already given you the listing about the fact that how many people got sober in 1938. But this is, to me, this is only a single source to take it for a, take it with a grain of salt the next time you do a Tradition 2 meeting, is that according to Mitchell, the job offer for Wilson at Towns was $700 a month. That's more than $144,000 in today's money, four times Silkworth's starting salary. Okay? And Nick, you know, the good might be the enemy of the best, but Bill didn't talk at all about what money he was offered as part of that town's offer and what he ended up giving up when he didn't have a pot to piss in. And think of that the next time you go through a Tradition too, because that is one of the things, money, property, and prestige diverted from our primary purpose, so he didn't put money in there, but I consider that to be truly remarkable. So Wilson not only learned that money could not buy happiness, money couldn't buy him sobriety either. And we get finally around to Towns' contributions to AA. Who was the dreamer? Hank Parkhurst, sometime in 1938, is quoted, "It may seem ridiculous, but one estimate has been made that 500,000 volumes would be sold in the next 2 years. Charles Townsend, on the other hand, wrote to Wilson on October 19, 1938, "I believe John D. Rockefeller will find that it is up to him to present a copy to every religious institution in the world and in every public library. In other words, I think that he could distribute 500,000 copies." So actually, Parkhurst is right along with Townsend on that subject. Townsend is October 4, 1945, the letter to Wilson. "I have never sought any credit or publicity in this matter, and I don't care for any, but under the circumstances, I don't think Mr. Rockefeller should receive all the credit for which he had nothing whatsoever to do with. As you recall, in the presence of Dr. Silkworth, I voluntarily suggested that a book should be written about this movement, and I also suggested that you be the man to write it." Again, single source. Take that with a grain of salt. "I voluntarily propose that you hire a stenographer, which you considered could be done for $25 a week, and that you wanted was an advance of $50 for a week yourself. There's nothing I can think of which has given so much or so little personal contribution." That was written when he was 83 years old. Go. Wilson about Town's support for the book project, again written to Frank Amos on January 4, 1939. This is Bill writing, "Mr. Townes has subsidized me at the rate of $200 per month, plus $100 more per month than the secretary who has worked for me. Townes did loan $4,194.66, roughly half of the cost of the book project, over a period of 13 months beginning in March of 1938 through April 21 of 1939, for which he was repaid in full eventually." Again, that was... he was the first of the creditors to pay paid off as well. Go. And there is the check register that came out of the... that's actually from the Town's Hospital check register. And you can see it was the 13 entries. Then there was $794.66 for the printing cost. So you can see that's actually... that was provided to me by... Bill Schaberg, thank heavens. And that's when the book would have been published without Townes is anybody's guess. Go. Townes helped give AA its first big break in the book sales with the Liberty Magazine article. This is, again, "Charlie had been raising heaven and earth to get publicity for us, and it succeeded. He had known Morris Markey for years. Intrigued with the story of A.A., Markey had approached Fulton Orsler, then editor of Liberty Magazine. The great editor, writer, and friend to be had instantly seen the possibilities and commissioned Morris Markey to do a piece. Several hundred books were sold as a result of the September 1939 article titled Alcoholics and God. Charles Townes turned out to be the right man at the right time to push Alcoholics Anonymous into selling books by the hundreds." Townes died in 1947 at the age of 85. His son, Colonel Ed Townes, took over administration of Townes Hospital by 1944. Purging poisons from the body represented a considerable school of thought, included Dr. John Harvey Kellogg of Battle Creek, which I've already gone to. According to David Musto, it will suffice to note that Townes' method had so many social and political pressures favoring it that refutation was difficult for a decade after its publication. It seemed to succeed because of the